Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio, working from home on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, April 15th, 2021. The United Nations says displaced people in West Darfur State are living in dire conditions.
Calm has returned to the town, but the displaced persons are suffering. Hundreds of them are living on the streets because public institutions are already full, and when night comes it's a bit cold, and yet the majority of them flee with nothing.
And a local organization in South Sudan is using an innovative method to address the problem of garbage management.
Our major target is now the non-degradables because they have soil side effect to the soil and environment, that is the plastic. We change all the plastic into building material.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UNOCHA in Sudan, says the security situation in Al Jineina town of West Darfur State is improving, with no shootings reported in the past 4 days. UNOCHA says the people displaced from their homes during the last week's violence need, among other things, shelter, food, non-food items, water and sanitation, as well as protection including psychosocial support. Officials say power outages and fuel shortages continue to affect water supplies and negatively impacting the local population. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
No shootings have been reported over the last 4 days, according to a statement released Wednesday night by the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UNOCHA. The recent fighting displaced thousands of people who have taken refuge in more than 51 gathering sites across Al Jineina. The number of people affected by the recent conflict is still unclear, as assessments have yet to take place. More than 1,800 people fled to the neighboring Chad since the recent clashes erupted on April 3rd, bringing the total number to 5,000, including those who fled since January, according to the UN statement. Power has been restored in some parts of the town, but the city water supply remains cut off. The price of one barrel of water has jumped from 200 Sudanese pounds to unprecedented 2,000 Sudanese pounds, or $5.24. The UN says sanitation continues to be a problem, with limited facilities available at the gathering sites, raising concerns about disease outbreaks. Health facilities are running out of medical and supplies. Speaking by phone from Al Jineina Teaching Hospital, Dr. Adam Zakaria calls the situation horrible.
Calm has returned to the town, but the displaced persons are suffering. Hundreds of them are living on the streets because public institutions are already full, and when night comes it's a bit cold, and yet the majority of them flee with nothing, and at the end of the day their security in that open space is not guaranteed.
Dr. Zakaria says the death toll continues to climb as security personnel patrol affected neighborhoods. He says the hospital has confirmed 207 deaths and more than 230 injured people. He says 42 of the injured have been airlifted to Khartoum for further medical attention. He says state authorities are not protecting medical workers who respond to health emergencies. Last weekend, a group of doctors and nurses were brutally attacked by armed men in military uniform as they were returning home at night, according to Dr. Zakaria.
In case of any emergency anywhere, we are supposed to quickly respond immediately and save the lives of the people. But at the moment, this is not the situation. Our medical staff are not given any consideration for protection at all.
The head of Sudan's Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and a delegation of military and intelligence officers visited Al Jineina on Monday. Dr. Zakaria says al-Burhan's delegation did not visit any of the injured in his hospital, or the hundreds of displaced persons sheltering in open spaces around the town.
He visited only the military institutions, and he only instructed the military leaders to increase more troops into the state to help in maintaining the security in the area, and he tried to console people that such incidents will not happen again, which is just a political statement that has been going on in Sudan.
UN OCHA says a rapid needs assessment is required in order to begin distributing relief aid. The UN statement says access to safe water and sanitation remains a major problem, noting that half of the sites where the displaced are gathering are inaccessible and that overcrowding is increasing the risk of disease outbreaks. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
A local organization in South Sudan is using an innovative method to effectively address the problem of garbage management, which remains a challenge in the capital, Juba. The innovation combats both degradable and non-degradable waste and transforms it into building materials and fertilizers. Godi Iswala Safi, Executive Director for Health Food Security and Livelihood Africa, or HF Africa, says the innovation will help in addressing environmental pollution, climate change, and unemployment. Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Godi Iswala Safi, Executive Director for Health Food Security and Livelihood Africa, bans plastic bottles and other waste materials at one of his organization's sites in Cor William, a suburb located south of the capital, Juba. Safi's organization collects huge quantities of garbage, the majority of which is plastic drinking water bottles. The bottles and other waste materials are collected from several dumping sites in Juba and placed in a metallic container where it is burnt until it decomposes into a liquid substance. The substance is then scooped into a molder of 20 by 15 centimeters using a spade. A small amount of sand and soil are added into the substance in the molder and mixed together using a trowel. Safi says the mixed substance is left to solidify and hardens for about 5 to 10 minutes and laid off into various building materials.
Our major target is now the non-degradables because they have soil side effect to the soil and environment, that is the plastic. We change all the plastic into building material. We have three products in the plastics. We have interlock bricks, we have the eco tiles, we have the pavers. Very beautiful pavers for designing the compound.
Safi says it takes one full tipper truck of plastic bottles to produce just one interlocking brick. Some of the plastic waste being decomposed into building materials includes old plastic chairs, old clothes, shoes, baskets, and other rubber materials. Safi uses simple materials such as firewood, paraffin, and diesel to form the various degradable and non-degradable wastes into various building materials and fertilizers. He says waste materials like discarded food are used to make fertilizer. Plastic bottles are a common waste material not only in Juba but across the country. Used water bottles are seen everywhere along roads, in markets, residential areas, and many undesignated dumping sites. Safi says he started thinking about innovative ways to address the problem of waste management in South Sudan nearly 2 years ago. He believes his idea of burning plastic water bottles and recycling it into building material and fertilizer can address the problem of global warming caused by climate change. But Safi admits his innovation faces some obstacles as he tries to expand the campaign on a larger scale.
Insecurity. If you go out of Juba town 5 miles, 10 miles to improve community there, you are attacked by unknown people. People abuse you, you can be kidnapped. That's one of the challenges. We don't have donor funding. Since we began this activity, no donor has shown interest in funding us.
There are no statistics in South Sudan as to how many plastic bottles are being manufactured and tossed away in the country. One U.S.-based distribution and marketing company called GoPure, which makes consumer products that it says improve people's health and helps sustain the environment, reports that humans worldwide purchase 1 million plastic water bottles per minute, 91% of which are not recycled. Plastic water bottles contain a sizable amount of bisphenol A or BPA, a substance that has been classified as an endocrine disruptor, meaning it bears a toxic effect on a human's ability to reproduce. Plastic water bottles also contain plastic softeners known as phthalates, which can also be toxic to humans. Safi says besides combating the waste problem caused by discarded water bottles, his initiative addresses the problem of youth unemployment. HF Africa has recruited 7 volunteers who are engaged in recycling the plastic waste. Safi says the volunteers gather and weigh the bottles and help turn the bottles into building materials and fertilizer. 26-year-old Amina Hafiz Lazim has been unemployed since completing her secondary education a few years ago. Hafiz volunteers at HF Africa, where she has worked as a secretary for the past 2 years.
It was challenging, but now it is fair. This volunteerism is better than when one is staying at home doing nothing. It is something very good in a life of a human being, gaining experience and learning many more things.
Although the HF Africa campaign is working on a small scale due to a lack of resources, Safi hopes it will expand in the future to a point where it can have a measurable impact on global warming and reducing waste in South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Major South African cities are facing the threat of land invasion as people become more desperate to get free houses due to COVID-19 economic challenges. Use of tear gas and stun grenades by police in Cape Town, Johannesburg, and Pretoria has become more frequent to prevent angry crowds of people who decide to occupy any vacant land in sight. Thusu Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The hunger for land is growing and South African cities are not coping. Police have had their hands full in recent months as citizens demand a piece of land. The invaders are people largely staying in informal settlements around the cities and those who can no longer afford to pay rent. In the coastal city of Cape Town alone, 1,025 incidents of land invasions were recorded since March last year. Authorities say these invasions have cost the city over $8 million. In Rubberidge, a township south of Johannesburg, hundreds of people decided to erect tin houses on vacant land. They argue that the land belongs to the government and is their right to occupy it and build houses they so desperately need. But the government says it is private land. Sizwe Shange is one of the residents who have inverted the piece of land in Rubberidge.
We're fighting for this land. This land has been here for 40 years and it hasn't been barricaded. And you can't claim and say that the land belongs to me if you don't say no trespassers. And it should be barricaded to show that it belongs to someone else.
Police have to use rubber bullets and stun grenades to get the people off the land. However, in retaliation, they are constantly barricading roads with stones and burning tires, vowing to occupy the land at whatever cost. Land cartels are also taking advantage of the desperation for houses and making nice profits in the process. In the area of Vlaagfontein, also in Johannesburg, a land baron has grabbed private land earmarked for a $1 million housing project and started selling it to desperate house seekers. The landowner, who did not want his identity revealed, says shacks and brick and mortar houses have been erected, leaving them clueless on what to do.
There's a gentleman selling our properties out to people and claiming the land belongs to him, threatening us that they'll burn us down if we interfere and we will never get a land and land belongs to him. And we're getting no help from the government or the police force in Didier even to get rid of the guy.
The capital, Pretoria, has not been spared. Up to 300 people have invaded vacant land east of the city and erected informal structures. A Thekwini Municipality spokesperson, Msawake Maisela, says the tourist-preferred city of Durban has not been spared.
There are instances whereby land is invaded in areas that are not suitable for human settlements. When the disaster strikes, we are expected as the city to come to the rescue of the people that have invaded land.
But Nomsa Sizani from Abahlali Bemjondolo, an organization fighting for those living in informal settlements in cities to be given land to build proper houses, says access to land cannot be limited to those who can afford to buy it.
People should occupy the places. They should not be evicted.
It's now over 25 years since South Africa ended apartheid, but a vast percent of its land remains in the hands of the minority whites. Attempts to redistribute it has been met with legal interdicts. A bill to expropriate land without compensation is now in parliament. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, we look at wildlife protection in Africa right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
who comes first in your life?
My sister comes first because she was the one who raised me. She taught me how to do everything, so she comes first.
Definitely God, but I think when talking about people, I think my family and my friends, just people who I've, you know, surrounded myself with.
I think the woman that I love, every moment I think about her, every moment I wish I'm around her, because she makes me happy. She gives me a lot of peace. She has a way of helping me to just relax and calm down.
My mom comes first in my life because she has really done a whole lot for me, and if there's anything, I would really want to do something to Anna Hay.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Although Africa is understandably famous for its iconic wildlife, it is also home to many endangered species such as the mountain gorilla, grazing zebra, the Ethiopian wolf, and the pangolin. Protecting them while establishing sustainable relationships with their human neighbors will be key to the continent's future. But some conservationists are increasingly insistent that to get their fellow Africans motivated to help, they must be led by experts and policymakers who have African sensibilities and points of view. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Kadu Wei Shebuna, President and CEO of the African Wildlife Foundation, the largest African-led international conservation organization. Shebuna began by criticizing the outsized influence of Europeans and American NGOs have on how wildlife is cherished and conserved.
We cannot afford to continue having conservation on the continent led by foreigners. Majority of NGOs and efforts to conserve wildlife is led by foreigners. The few Africans are white Africans. We need black Africans that support conservation on the continent to grow our constituency.
I know with the African Wildlife Foundation, you've had a lot of experience with this.
Absolutely. I've met so many African leaders who, in the first few minutes, think that I have a foreign agenda because I'm talking about conservation.
Where is that view coming from?
The fact that Africans have only heard from foreigners telling them why conservation is important. We need to hear Africans telling Africans. Remember, Africa has been managing wildlife and consuming wildlife for centuries. But once it starts becoming a business, that you are going to kill a pangolin from a village, transport it 200 miles away, put it on a plane, and export it. Already through that value chain, you've lost the experience and the local knowledge of how do you handle a pangolin and what's your relationship to it.
You've been telling me that until recently, most Africans have had an emotional or even a spiritual connection to animals, particular animals too, depending on where they're from.
Absolutely. I belong to a black and white Columbus monkey. That is my name. That is my clan. That's who I am. I do anything in my power to protect a black and white monkey. All Africans are like me. And what we are losing is that connection. That is going to only come when Africans discuss conservation with Africans.
What is the Western, or shall we say, imported view of conservation?
Conservation of the continent is entirely based on science. And the history of conservation is not very good on the continent. I worked in Latin America. There, it's mostly about indigenous people and their rights to land. And in Africa, it's about protecting wildlife from people, which has translated into wildlife is owned by everybody and nobody. It's a public good. And we cannot continue to accept that Africans living next to national parks value a chicken more than a leopard or a rhino.
Why do they place that sort of lesser value on wildlife?
Why? If you have a goat, you can marry. If you have two pigs, you can buy land. But you cannot pay medical bills because you live next to a rhino. The rhino definitely has more value than a chicken. But how do you get Africans to value a rhino more than a chicken? What we need to do is to put that value in front of Africans because they need to see that direct benefit. And it's possible in the areas where we work, we have managed to do that with private landowners and communal landowners.
How does that work?
It is very simple. People who come to see these rhinos, they pay $2,000, $3,000 a day. How many chickens are those? In Rwanda, we built a lodge with communities. This is one of the highest end lodge in Rwanda. Communities earn more than $500,000 annually from their lodge. To break it down for you, communities partner with a private operator that is paid a fee. The community, they earn the revenue and they've been able to sustain their families. In Botswana, one tour company hires more women than any other rural company outside agriculture.
So zooming out a bit, what's your message, big picture?
It's how we design tourism. It's how we design ownership. It's how we design relationships. What we are struggling with now is how do you scale it up to the level that actually supports more Africans and supports the national economies. But it's possible.
That was Kadu Wei Shabuna, President and CEO of the African Wildlife Foundation, is speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. One of South Africa's top crime fighters says if President Cyril Ramaphosa sticks to his word and launches an all-out war against corruption, almost all of his government colleagues will be in jail. Private forensic investigator Paul O'Sullivan is a legend of law enforcement in democratic South Africa. His work has led to the downfall of organized crime bosses, corrupt police commissioners, and many more. Darren Tyler reports.
O'Sullivan's on so many criminals' hit lists, he says he's been shot three times, and he killed one of the attackers. He doesn't want bodyguards, saying he doesn't like others doing his dirty work. O'Sullivan says he won't stop uncovering corruption until those pillaging South Africa are behind bars.
That's why these people want to kill me, I don't know, two, three times a year. We have to live behind high walls with electric fences and vicious dogs on the inside. And then if they do climb over the wall, obviously, you know, I have to shoot them. But the bottom line is we have to...
He's been dodging death ever since he began investigating financial crimes as a policeman in the mid-1990s. These days, he says, the police, instead of helping him, often seem bent on disrupting his investigations, especially when he's intent on charging senior members of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, with crimes.
We got a case recently where one of my staff went into a police station to open a docket, and the cop behind the counter told my staff member, "Oh, but you've typed out the affidavit. No, that's not allowed. It must be handwritten." And she's a lawyer. And she said, "No, I'm sorry, but with all due respect, you are wrong." And he wouldn't have any of it. He said, "Well, I'm not allowing you to open that docket."
The police animosity towards O'Sullivan is perhaps understandable, since his works led to the imprisonment of more than a few top cops, including former police commissioner Jackie Selebi.
When I was investigating Jackie Selebi back in 2003, everybody said I was bombing. I said, "No, the chief of police is corrupt." They said, "Oh, you're talking rubbish." I said, "No, I'm telling you, with skills that I picked up many years ago when I was working for the British government. I infiltrated the crime syndicate around Jackie Celebi.
He says the way Celebi established a criminal organization within the police is still happening today in certain government departments.
He was promoting people that had absolutely no skills whatsoever, but they were getting promoted because they were loyal to him. Somebody's a sergeant one day and a captain or a major or a colonel the next day or a brigadier.
O'Sullivan says to begin a successful probe into graft in a government office is simple. Establish how fast certain people close to the boss have climbed the ladder. Then target one or two who may protect themselves by spilling the beans on their corrupt overlord. O'Sullivan says he believes Ramaphosa when the president says he wants to stop corruption. But the investigator is equally convinced the ANC's beyond redemption. The ruling party says O'Sullivan's a blowhard, an attention seeker, and unpatriotic. O'Sullivan responds that it's very interesting that he doesn't call him a liar. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Mudu. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the coronavirus pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and noses when we are in crowded areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
We love to hear what you think about this show. Send your brief comments about issues in our news or happening in your area. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. We will air your comments every Friday. And that's our show for this Thursday. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. Thank you for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, wear a mask when in public places, and do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for COVID-19. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America.